From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Radio Boise studios in Boise, Idaho. It's a great place to be, and I'd like to thank Jeff and his team for the warm, warm welcome here. It was March 2013 that I last made an urgent appeal to you, our listeners, to keep this show on the air with a financial contribution. Many of you came through for us, and it's thanks to your generosity that you're hearing me right now. We put off another big push for funding for as long as we could, but the time is now and the need is great. So I want to ask you to take the time this week to go to stateofbelief.com and do what you can to make sure this conversation is not silenced. You and I both know there are many who need to hear this program now more than ever. www.stateofbelief.com. Thank you. Here's what's coming up on this week's show.
I would like to go to rabbinical school and become a rabbi. Do you know where Boise is? Yes. That is good, since you will probably be working in Boise when you graduate.
One of the interesting things about this country is how little we know about vast parts of it. The national media concentrated in New York and California, what is often derided as flyover country, is home, not only to a rich tapestry of American culture and diversity, but is increasingly the place where profound changes in law and public policy first take root. Thanks to an event hosted by Interfaith Alliance of Idaho, I'm in Boise, Idaho this week. And on this week's show, you'll meet one of the very few leaders of Reform Judaism in this state, environmental activist Rabbi Daniel Fink.
An invasion facilitated by our own government.
The sexualization that has taken place in our culture in general, but in college campuses, it leads to tyranny.
You know, the only problem with the world is the unequal distribution of capitalism. That's the real problem.
There seems to be no end to the right-wing rhetoric emanating from American talk radio. But if you scan the dial for a greater diversity of voices, all too often there is a deafening silence. 2014 started with news of the death of several major market progressive talk stations in L.A., San Francisco, and New York City, stations that carried our program back when we were distributed by the Air America Network. Despite the explosion in new digital media, many millions of listeners consume many hundreds of talk programs, and almost without exception, those programs align themselves with a certain narrow view of our nation and of our world. On this week's show, we'll talk to Jeff Abrams, who is the station manager for Radio Boise here in Idaho, driven not by ideological dogma, but by a commitment to building community through broadcasting. But first,
scriptures were telling us to feed the poor, to clothe the naked, to offer hospitality to a stranger. We're not called to ask for people's immigration status before we do these things.
Arizona. News coverage in other parts of the country would leave one thinking of the state as the base for John Secure the Border First McCain, the notorious and court-blocked Papers Please Law, and Sheriff Joe Arpaio. But there are no red states nor blue states, not really. Joining me right now is a woman who is every bit as invested in the immigration issue as the loudest of the anti-immigrant voices. But her work is infused with a scriptural context that's missing from the rhetoric of the kick 'em all out crowd. The Reverend Allison Harrington is pastor of Southside Presbyterian Church. I'm very happy to have her with us on State of Belief Radio. Allison, welcome.
Thank you so much.
If you would please start by talking briefly about the sanctuary movement.
The sanctuary movement was a predominantly faith-based movements arising out of the great humanitarian crisis we found ourselves in during the 1980s when thousands of people were flooding across our border, fleeing the civil wars in places like El Salvador and Guatemala, places in Central America. They were flooding over our borders seeking asylum. And when the U.S. government wasn't offering asylum and instead was deporting them back to death squads, the church stepped up and offered them sanctuary, offered them hospitality within the walls of their churches, but also within their homes and within their hearts, and provided a safe place for them until that time in which they could have a asylum status within the United States.
How did your congregation get involved in this?
Back in the 80s, we were witnesses of people kind of showing up at the church, showing up in our community that were migrating for very different reasons than the migration that is typically seen here in the borderlands, which is more kind of economic, moving back and forth between the United States and Mexico. And these were certainly folks that were from further away and were coming for different reasons. And so my church began to respond to that in the only way that it knew how, and began to welcome them into their church families.
Talk about the case of a man named Daniel.
Daniel is a man in our community. He's not a stranger to us. He's a neighbor. He's someone who's well known to his community, to his own church family. And he came to us, his lawyer and him came to us about 3 weeks ago now and asked for sanctuary. He had a final order of deportation on him, which meant that on May 14th, they could do what they often do, is they often come into people's homes, and this is Border Patrol or immigration, will come into people's homes and break down the doors and in a very violent way with guns, and will apprehend a person and tear them away from their family and then deport them. And so he had come to us to say, could I have sanctuary here at your church? And we felt that he was a very compelling case. He is a wonderful man who's lived here for 14 years, has paid federal and state taxes. He has a U.S.-born son, leader of his church, and we knew that his case was one that was very compelling and one that was very representative of the people that President Obama has said should not be a priority for deportation. So since May 13th, he has been living here at the church in sanctuary.
So why was it important for Southside to take that step? Was there a lot of debate about it, or were they simply ready to do it? And if so, why?
Well, I think the reason we've been center in a lot of these immigration issues, both back in the 80s as a founding church of the sanctuary movement, and now today, during this fight for immigration reform and for migrant rights, we've been the center of these debates because of who we are as Christians and where we are as a congregation. 60 miles from the border puts us right smack dab in the middle of an enormous amount of human need. And also, you know, we believe in Christ, and we believe that to be a disciple of Christ is to care for the stranger, to love our neighbor, to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. And so definitely there was discussion, but we felt that though there may be risks, this was what we were being called to do as a congregation.
Well, are there legal risks? And if they are, what are the legal risks involved in this?
Well, one thing that I've discovered through this process is law is kind of like scripture. It's kind of up to everyone's interpretation. So there are some lawyers who will say, concealing Daniel, and so you can't be guilty of harboring. There's others that say, oh, no, definitely you could be guilty of harboring. But, you know, here we say, better in trouble with the law than in trouble with the Lord. And we really feel strongly called to provide sanctuary for this man. And it's been hard in a lot of ways to see this family suffer and to watch them as they anxiously wait for news from Washington, D.C. But there's also a lot of joy in it because they're such a lovely family who love each other so much and whose faith in the Lord is absolutely fundamental to their life as a family. And so there's been a lot of laughter and a lot of joy that has come from welcoming them into our church family.
Mm-hmm. How many people can you help like this?
That's a really good question. You know, back in the, we had tens of thousands of people who came through this church in the 1980s. It was a very different context and a different historical moment. We're not sure how many we can help, but, you know, every day living in the Southern Arizona region, every day I'm afraid we're not doing enough because we are seeing over and over again people disappeared from our communities that we don't hear from again for months and months later when they turn up in a detention center in Louisiana or they're back over the border, and I always feel like we're not doing enough. And so I'm grateful that we've had the opportunity to at least stand alongside this one family.
As you look at the future, what is the ultimate resolution of these kinds of cases that you have as your goal?
President Obama has said that we shouldn't be in the business of tearing apart families. And I think that's an important thing to not be in the business of, tearing apart families. And there's been a lot of policies that have been passed and acknowledged by the Obama administration that says if folks have U.S. citizen children, they shouldn't be deported. And so I think moving forward, I'm hopeful that cases like Daniel's will be closed. I'm also hoping for a humane immigration reform that will have as one of its foundational principles unity of the family and reunification of family, I think is really important. You know, I've been thinking a lot about our faith and what compels us to do this. And a lot of times we do use the guidepost of welcoming the stranger and knowing that when we welcome the stranger, we welcome Christ. And I think that that was important for the sanctuary movement because those were strangers. But now we're seeing people who are not our strangers. They're our community members. And so I think that there are other scripture passages that should be kind of a beacon for us. You know, the scripture passages to care for the widow and the orphan. Well, I think we need to act sooner. And I think we need to love our neighbors and try to act to prevent the creation of widows and orphans through our broken immigration system. So really looking at how do we hold up the preciousness of the family as something that should not be violated by broken immigration laws. I think that's an important role that the church has within this particular historical moment.
How optimistic are you that there is a way forward considering Congress's seeming inability to act?
Well, I'm a Christian, so that means I'm a person of hope and faith.
Yes.
More than anything else. And so it's a hard historical moment because it really feels that our representatives in Congress are playing politics with people's families. And they're more concerned about politics and about re-election and about the future of their party than they are about the future of children in the United States. You know, children whose parents are being taken from them. So here's my hope is. My hope is in the church. My hope is in communities of faith. And I think back to moments in our history like the Civil Rights Movement when, you know, the U.S. government was hesitant to make any fundamental changes, but it was because of the persistent faith and the power of the church that they had to yield to the voice of morality. Mm-hmm. And I'm hopeful for that again. I'm hopeful that other churches will see this as a time in which we can speak up. And it can be overwhelming when we think about 1,100 people a day being deported. That can be an overwhelming number, and a church can feel like, well, what are we going to do about that? And you can think about all the politics and all the complicatedness of our immigration laws. But then you can look a father in his eyes, and suddenly it does not seem like a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
To say, we're not going to let you be taken away from your 13-year-old son, Carlos. That's an easy thing to do. But you have to kind of look in those eyes and be engaged in that community. And so I really have a lot of hope that the church, that faith communities, that synagogues, that mosques will begin to do that. And then our elected representatives, those folks we pray for every Sunday, that they will have no choice but to have a conversion.
Yeah. Allison, what action are you calling for on the groundswellmovement.org?
Thank you. People can go to groundswell-movement.org, and they can sign a petition asking the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson to close Daniel's case.
Mm-hmm. How can our listeners keep in touch with what you're doing, your work at the local or national level?
We will have updates on our website, and that's southsidepresbyterian.org.
The Reverend Allison Harrington is pastor of Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona. Along with many other faith communities across this country, the church has opened its doors to provide sanctuary to one young undocumented immigrant in a demonstration of scriptural and basic human values. They're actually trying to be what a church ought to be. And Allison, I can't tell you how much I respect what you've done in your ministry in that church and how important it is for other congregations to look at your congregation and follow in their footsteps. I really do appreciate you sharing the story with us on State of Belief Radio yourself, and I hope we can talk again.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
Hosting for this week's show is our Boise, Idaho affiliate, Radio Boise. I wanted to get a better understanding of what it takes in 2014 to offer a community its own radio station. That's why I'm so happy to be joined now by Radio Boise station manager, Jeff Abrams. Jeff, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
And listen, man, I'm so happy that you carry our show. It gives us a lot of affirmation.
Well, Pam's work in this state really did a lot to foster that relationship between not only the state chapter of Interfaith Alliance, but the awareness that I needed to develop about your programming and how universal its applications really are to our listening audience.
Talk about Radio Boise.
It's a sacred responsibility for us now that we have it, but it was basically 10 years in the making. What we did was to create a place from scratch that we had never experienced in this community before. Mm-hmm. We filled in a gap. If you look at the map of America, we were the biggest place in the country that didn't have community-based radio. Mm-hmm. So we now serve about 400,000 people in this community. That we could actually do that and as a community reclaim the voice that some of us didn't even know we had to begin with and others felt like was missing something to connect to each other. And in this place that can potentially be a marginalizing area of the country and where voices maybe don't get out, we now feel like we can be that conduit, that connective tissue for all the fantastic things that are happening in this community.
So how did you get involved in it?
My background is in advertising and also in fisheries biology. I actually heard somebody speaking. His name is Dr. Richard Florida, and he spoke on what it is that it takes, the environmental conditions in a community, to retain and attract creative types. And one of the main criteria that he developed, that he came to town and said that he felt like we were lacking in, was what he called a diversity index. And this diversity index basically is an attractant for creative types that want a place that they can feel like their lifestyle is fostered, where they feel comfortable in their own skin, and where they feel accepted as creative people, whatever shape and size they happen to come in. And so Dr. Florida came to this town after benchmarking these metrics all across the country in 30 metropolitan areas. And he said, Boise, you're doing fantastic in most of these metrics. However, you're really falling down when it comes to this diversity index. And that just kind of started me thinking, you know, what a fantastic way to prompt and foster this diversity index is to create a place where we can talk about issues or we can discuss our future as a community without that lens, without that filter of a corporate media-driven agenda.
Jeff, what are the challenges to building a programming schedule that reflects a community's diversity?
we want to represent voices in the community, but yet we also want our programming to be compelling. When you're programming a community-based station in 2014, what you try to do is create a schedule that's cohesive, that is something that reflects the diversity of the community, but yet people can follow on a daily basis.
Jeff, were there people in the community that did not want the station to come on the air?
There were folks who didn't believe it could be done technically.
Uh-huh.
Rewind our economic history three, 4 years back, and you tell me if you think it was if the conditions were fertile to foster philanthropic energy towards a organization that had no track record at all and had a fairly healthy appetite for a capital budget. And so there were naysayers, I think, in both the technical spectrum and in the economic spectrum. There's no doubt that the prevailing sentiments in regards to radio at times make us question, which they should, the efficacy of this model in 2014, where there are business models out there that are so varied. When people want stuff on demand, and if it's not exactly what they want, they change.
Right.
What we're trying to do is create programming that is compelling enough so that you don't necessarily need to like everything you hear on the station, but you recognize that it's the most authentic way that you can plug into what's happening in your community.
That's well said. Jeff, why radio? I get asked that question all the time. Why not a website? Why not a Facebook page? Why not podcast? What is so special about this medium, even with all the new technology that's out there? Why still radio?
Radio is something that is intimate. You don't need a sophisticated device. You don't need something that can get in the way of your experience. And there's a huge element of it that is so imaginative. And so you can be listening, whether you're cooking or whether you're driving your kids to their soccer game. And all it takes is flashes of engagement with what you're hearing, and they evoke memories and they evoke thoughts. And it's a medium that is very immediate in that way, that it connects without the distractions of a visual screen, without the high production value of television, and without the detachment of the social media universe that's so ubiquitous now. To me, the other thing is that radio is a device that, as the founder of Bush Radio in Cape Town, South Africa said, who just died, Zain Ibrahim, he said radio is 10% about radio and 90% about community. And to me, it is the most relevant device for us to connect to each other as humans, because we're all experiencing this at the same time. So when this show airs, Reverend, there will be thousands of people who will be feeling this moment with us at the same time, this conversation. They'll be here at the table with us. And you don't get that with any other medium.
Yeah. Why do you think extreme conservative voices have had seemingly an easy time getting into radio and becoming popular? Is it, and not so much for more progressive voices, is it something about radio, or have they just had a concerted effort and the money to back it up? What's your answer on that?
I think in a nutshell, what's happened is that the voices that represent conservative radio, they do have the money, but if they didn't have their voice, they wouldn't have the money. So if you're talking about progressive radio and its shortcomings, or the fact that its model maybe has not proven itself out, I think it's all about the voice and the content. And Radio Boise is really not necessarily placing ourselves in the conservative or a progressive camp. What we're trying to do is foster a discussion. But what I hear on commercial radio, and, you know, we can have another half-hour discussion about the economics and the business that is driving conservative radio,
right,
and the lobby and the legislation that is directly tied to those media voices. But we probably that is a whole nother conversation.
Yes,
nevertheless, that is a huge dynamic as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take time, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, the delivery mechanism of radio is most appropriate when it comes from communities
mm-hmm.
and not national spokespeople. The conversations that you're having on your program
mm-hmm.
are relevant to people because people, wherever they're listening, are impacted by those issues
mm-hmm.
that you're prompting us to have discussions about. But to me, radio at its best is something that's delivered locally.
Mm-hmm. One more question. What's one thing that our listeners on the coast don't know about Idaho, but you think they should know?
Well, for me, coming to Idaho 20 years ago, growing up in Southern California, the idea that Idaho really is a place that people can come to make a difference, I don't think that this would have been possible in most of California. I don't think that the impact that people have in this community would be felt as magnificently as it is if they were in another town mm-hmm. in a large state where efforts sometimes are dwarfed. If you want to put your thumbprints in this community and on this state, you can do that here in Idaho,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, there's very few states anymore where you can really feel like you're making a difference. And so, you know, we talked about the marginalizing culture at times in Idaho and in some Western regions. But if you feel like you have something to say, and if you feel like there's a debate that's getting squashed because there are so many dominant corporate interests involved, and filter and tell us what that agenda should be instead of just neighbors talking to each other, if you want to make that happen in the state, you actually can. It's been an honor to experience. And after 20 years, I feel like the state has grown, because folks are here that are passionate and want to make a difference in their communities.
Mm. Jeff Abrams is station manager at Radio Boise, our affiliate in this great city. Jeff, I want to thank you again for having us in your studios this week, and I thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio every week. It's a pleasure to work with you.
Well, thank you so much for creating the content that we can air, because it's important, and the discussions that you initiate need to be taking place in every community across the country.
I do want to remind our listeners that it's time once again to consider whether you think the conversations you hear every week on State of Belief are important to you. It's important to us that you consider making a financial contribution today to help keep this show on the air. I urgently asked for your help in March of 2013, and you came through in a way that inspired the funding to keep us afloat for another year. And now it's time to ask you once again to go to stateofbelief.com to think about the kind of programming that you won't find anywhere else, and to make a generous donation to help us keep ourselves on the air and keep modeling civility on the great issues that face our nation and our world. Go to www.stateofbelief.com. I thank you in advance. We look forward to hearing from you. Rabbi Daniel Fink leads Congregation Ahavath Beth Israel in Boise, Idaho, affiliated with the Union of Reform Judaism. The community meets in the oldest synagogue building in continuous use west of the Mississippi. And for at least another month, Rabbi Daniel Fink, who's been here 20 years, will be the only Reformed rabbi in Idaho. Interfaith Alliance has had the pleasure of collaborating with Rabbi Fink in the past, and I'm very happy to have him join us now in studio on State of Belief Radio. Dan, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You're in kind of a unique role here in Idaho because you have been the only Reformed rabbi. Talk about your ministry and your congregation, if you would.
My congregation was established in 1895 as a Reformed congregation. About 90 years later, it merged with a conservative congregation. So we try really hard to reach across the Jewish spectrum and meet needs of a diverse array of people. And because for the first 10 years that I was here, I was not only the only Reform rabbi, I was the only rabbi in the state. So I ended up working with communities beyond Boise and also doing a lot of outreach work with the non-Jewish community. There had not been a rabbi in Idaho for the previous 100 years. So the synagogue was established in 1895. I was hired in 1994. For 99 years, there was no rabbi in the state at all.
That is amazing. Well, what are the dynamics for interreligious cooperation in Boise or in Idaho generally?
You know, for the most part, since I've been here, I've found the community really eager to learn more about Judaism and the Jewish community. We have lots of classes at the university level, high school kids coming to our services. People are interested, and people are overwhelmingly open and interested.
Are there particular initiatives that are coming out of your synagogue?
Well, we've been a part of the Interfaith Alliance and other social justice groups from the time that I've gotten here. When I went through the interview process, it was made very clear to me that the congregation really valued having a strong social justice voice in the community, that they had done that as lay leadership and that they were looking for their rabbi to continue in that tradition. So so it's been a pleasure and a privilege for me to be able to speak out on justice and environmental issues in our community and know that I've had the strong backing of my congregation and community.
Dan, I know you have a pretty intense focus on the environment, and I would like for you to talk about that, if you would.
Well, when I entered rabbinical school, I hadn't been very active Jewishly in my college years. That's really an understatement. I'd done almost nothing. My father was a rabbi, so I grew up in a very Jewish home, but I went off to college and took a vacation. So when I applied to rabbinical school, I couldn't really talk about the active Jewish life I'd been living in college. So I talked more instead about my spiritual life, which during those 4 years was really strongly focused on being nourished by being outdoors, camping, canoeing, kayaking, just enjoying the beauty of the natural world. So I walked into the interview, and I had written in my essay about being an environmentalist, and one of the professors, actually the person leading the committee, said, "What does all this nonsense have to do with Judaism, all this environmental nonsense?" And you know, it was aggressive. It was designed to see if I could respond to pressure, I think. But in a way, it was what we call a mitzvah. It was a good thing because it got me thinking about that question. How do I make a link between my commitment to being a Jew and my commitment to being an environmentalist? And where is my spirit nourished? And what is my obligation to give back? So I've been thinking about that and writing about it and learning about it with my community over the last 3 decades.
And I'm curious, as you've done that, are you surprised at how much your faith contributes to that, or what does your faith contribute?
You know, what I've discovered is that the spiritual roots and the spiritual experiences that I feel and gain through the power of the natural world aren't particularly Jewish. There's nothing uniquely Jewish about them at all, that they're really universal things, and that people of all faiths and people of no faith, I think, have the same feelings of awe, of wonder, the feeling of both my tininess amidst the vastness of the universe and also the power of being connected up with something so large. That all seems universal. What I've discovered is that each faith tradition has its own way of responding to those feelings and to those experiences. So as I've grown both as an environmentalist and as a Jew, what I've learned is that, okay, so when I as a Jew stand and look up at a mountain, there's a blessing that I can say, Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, osei ma'aseh bereishit. Praised are you, O God, who continues the work of creation. I think that a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim or a Hindu would very likely be feeling the same things, but their tradition would give them their own language to respond.
Mm-hmm. Idaho has some pretty unique natural resources going for it. How does that impact life here?
Well, it makes it a wonderful place to live for me. I think a lot of the people in my community are overwhelmingly not originally from Idaho. Most of my congregation has moved here from other places, and many people have been drawn by the natural beauty of the state. There are significant numbers of people who have come because they love to ski, to kayak, to camp, just to walk amidst the grandeur of creation. But with that privilege that we have, I think also comes the responsibility to be good stewards of what we've been given and where we are. And that's a source of where we have a lot of work still to do.
Do you do much work on the environment in terms of pushing for legislation or for conservation?
I do, and my congregation does. And right now we're part of an organization, an interfaith organization called Green Faith, that works with synagogues, churches, mosques all over the country, helps them to green their own congregation. So part of it is education within the congregation, education within each of your own traditions. So in our case, Judaism. But another requirement of Green Faith is an advocacy piece. So that fits well with what we've been doing. It isn't always easy in this state because the politics of Idaho can be pretty darn conservative, and it's not always considered a good thing among those who are sitting at the State House to identify as an environmentalist. It's a label I very proudly claim, but it's not an uncontroversial one here.
I'm just trying to think how I would feel if I'd say had been the only Christian minister in a state. I mean, how has that been? Did you feel lonely? Do you feel accepted now? What's that been like?
You know, the world is smaller than it used to be even 20 years ago when I got here. You get on a listserv, you're part of a Facebook group. There are ways to communicate with and connect with the wider Jewish community now that didn't exist 20 years ago. So I go to conferences. I make connections. I grew up just outside of Washington, D.C., so I have friends and family. But in a way, I think being a little off the grid Jewishly gives us some opportunities because people come out here and they've often left aside some of the ways they grew up in terms of, okay, to be Jewish, you have to do X, Y, Z, and culturally it means this and this and this. And people get kind of stuck in their ways. So I think coming here creates a kind of window for change that you don't necessarily have in places where there are more entrenched Jewish institutions.
I want to ask you the same question that I put to Jeff Abrams earlier in the show. What do you think Americans in other parts of the country don't know about Idaho, but they should know?
I think Americans overwhelmingly think of Idaho and think of potatoes and white supremacists. You know, when I moved here 20 years ago, I moved here from Omaha, Nebraska, and people said, "There are Jews in Idaho?" And I said, "You're in Nebraska, in New York. They say the same thing about you." So, you know, mostly what I think people need to know about Idaho is that it's people going about their lives. It doesn't seem like an odd, exotic place to live when you're here. It just seems like a really lovely place, a place where because, at least within my Jewish community, mm-hmm. there are many, many, many people who didn't grow up here. So we have to be family to one another. And I've found that to be true in the community, that there's a sense of caring for each other and reaching out and supporting one another as family.
Rabbi Daniel Fink leads Congregation Ahavoth Beth Israel in Boise, Idaho. Dan, thanks for cooperating with the Interfaith Alliance across the years, and thanks for taking time today to come and talk with me on State of Belief Radio.
It's been a pleasure and a privilege. Thank you.
Now, before we go, earlier this week, as we were planning the show, we talked about doing a segment on the release of Bo Bergdahl, America's last prisoner of war in Afghanistan. Personally, I was interested in exploring the ethics of prisoner exchange, a post-conflict practice that is as old as war itself. While we're likely to address that issue on a future show, I'd like to take a minute to comment on the remarkable and relentless attacks on Barack Obama for freeing an active duty American soldier. The disingenuousness of the rhetoric has been nothing short of breathtaking. As our friend Rachel Maddow scrupulously documented, a long list of conservative political leaders at first celebrated Bergdahl's release, and then, as if guided by a dog whistle, deleted their congratulatory tweets, posts, and press releases, and proceeded to condemn the President of the United States, the POW, the POW's family, and anything else within firing range. These same leaders had complained that Obama had not done enough to free Bergdahl. And a member of them had grumbled that an exchange of prisoners shouldn't be so hard to do. But, of course, that was before the president did just what they had urged. Perhaps the dirtiest demonstration of what has come to pass for political discourse in this country came in the form of a fundraising email sent out by the Family Research Council president, Anthony Perkins. Perkins managed to contrast Barack Obama's action regarding Bergdahl with his supposed inaction in the case of Miriam Ibrahim, the woman in Sudan condemned to death because of her marriage to a Christian man. Set aside for a moment, if you will, that action in the latter case would out of necessity be taking place far from the public eye. And I don't think we've got any Sudanese captives lying around just waiting to be exchanged. How nakedly political does a group like FRC need to become before its supporters finally take notice of what they're really saying and doing? What kind of morality allows a prominent, supposedly religious leader to basically declare that the freeing of an American soldier captured and imprisoned for 5 years was somehow a mistake? Since when do we preemptively court-martial our men and women in uniform in the court of public opinion? There's a bitter anecdote about the more hypocritical of the anti-abortion and even anti-birth control activists who treasure every life until birth and then work to cut benefits for child nutrition and health. Now, this is kind of the same type of thing. It's patriotic to send our troops into battle, but somehow contemptible to work to bring them home. For politicians, politics is in their job description. And so even the most crass twists of logic can be understood as serving the purpose of knocking the president, no matter how transparently dishonest. But for leaders of well-funded organizations to lower themselves to the same level while claiming some kind of moral authority on religious grounds, well, you know, it just doesn't really get much lower than that. a president, this president, was wrong to work to free an American POW. That's the message from today's Family Research Council. What a shame. Not much there for Bo Bergdahl's family. Not much research either, when you look at the long history of post-conflict exchange of prisoners. And it sure wasn't wise counsel that led Perkins to lay his organization's credibility on the line just for the sake of a cheap political shot. So we'll discuss the ethics of prisoner exchange another time. But right now, let's never fail to notice how principles, human lives, and religion itself have become nothing more than cannon fodder in the anti-Obama culture wars. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. A few weeks ago, I announced that I would be retiring as president of Interfaith Alliance, a job that I've enjoyed and found immensely rewarding for almost 17 years. The retirement would come at the end of 2014. Since that announcement, one of the questions I've been asked most frequently is, what about State of Belief? So I want you to know it's my intention to continue hosting this show. I love meeting the people we have on this program. I love hearing their stories. I love sharing those conversations with you. I love being in local stations that carry our show like I am this week. We hear from listeners all the time about how important it is for them to hear thoughtful, respectful coverage of religion, politics, and culture that they can't find anywhere else. This program is a partnership. I've been working with my producer, Ray Kirstein, since 2010, but the most essential partner in this partnership of State of Belief Radio is you. We count on you. And we want to keep right on doing what we've been doing, but we do need your help, and we need it now. So I'm asking you to go to stateofbelief.com and make a tax-deductible donation to keep this show on the air. I hope you'll do it today, www.stateofbelief.com. And if you prefer to make a donation by check, the mailing address is right there on the website. Let's keep this partnership going, for goodness sakes, and thank you for being concerned about that. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You can stay in touch with us all through the week on Facebook and Twitter. Our listener line is 202-681-4246. As always, we encourage you to tell others about the show. Encourage them to listen so they will become a part of our regular conversation. And please join us again next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.